Accession number 30633, Mr. James Ferguson, Reel 14. Now, you were telling me about the capture of Arnhem, early April.
Yeah, I think it was probably April 14th. And it was a very easy operation for the army. They went in and in a course of a day, I think they'd probably taken the whole city. Nothing like what happened the previous autumn. And then we moved back. I think the gun detachments were moved out from their positions. We all presumably were billeted then where our troop headquarters was, in this housing estate on the south side of the river. And with very little delay, all our guns were taken off us to be sent to fight the Japs. And we became virtually infantry. General misery. I think everybody felt, what on earth do we do next? There wasn't much object in being there any longer.
Did you actually get any extra infantry training, or was it just you were turned into an infantry unit?
I think every gunner had a rifle, and we'd had a certain amount of rifle training anyhow in the course of the years.
Nothing extra, though?
No. But at that point, after a day or two, for the first day or so, Antwerp had been left booby-trapped, and there were bombs going off at intervals. You could hear them. I mean, I don't think much harm was done and not much loss of life. But there was a tendency, if you went into a loo and pulled a chain, that the cistern blew up above your head or something like that. And
had you been trained in identifying potential booby traps? Or
no, I think certainly not. And that naturally lasted a very short time. We were then ordered forward. Now, presumably we crossed a pontoon bridge. I think there was no surviving bridge there. There would have been two, or at least there would have been a railway bridge as well as the great road bridge. Incidentally, the approach to the road bridge, and indeed the road from Nijmegen up to Arnhem, was made unpleasant by the enormous number of dead animals. There were dead cattle lying along the sides of the road, and then the approaches to the bridge, there were many dead horses, which I'm afraid they were probably the German supply horses that they just left behind. But nobody did anything about it. They threw tarred stone over them, I think, sort of probably meant really for resurfacing the road. That's about the best they could do to try and damp them down. We were then moved to rest at a place called, on a farm, a place called Barnevelt.
Do you know how you spell that?
Barneveldt.
And that's across the Rhine?
That's north of the Rhine, yes. In the stretch of land between the... which is in the stretch of land between Arnhem and the south shore of the Zuider Zee. And there we stayed for two or three days, during which VE Day happened.
Now,
May the 5th or something like
that. 8th.
8th, was it? Yes. Well, I think the surrender was on about the 4th or 5th. And we were certainly there then. And on VE Day...
What was going on at Barnevelt? You were just in rest, were you?
We were simply resting, yes.
What sort of billets were you in?
I should guess that we were under canvas. It was glorious weather. Perfect spring weather. And again, apple blossom and that sort of thing everywhere. I can remember nothing about the farmers or anybody. I can remember nothing about what happened to the other ranks, I'm ashamed to say.
Now, what about any celebrations at the peace?
Yes. Now, on VE Day, we had always, of course, received officers who had a bottle of whiskey and half a bottle of gin a month, I think, we could buy. And that had been hoarded to some extent for the great day. We had a rum ration all the time, and I was responsible for issuing the rum, and it came in stone jars, and I forget exactly how. I wasn't dishonest in any way. I think I gave full ration to everybody, but somehow, somebody or other had been filtering a little bit off, keeping it. And I remember on, when we were in Arnhem, I think. Oh, perhaps the surrender happened, yes, while we were in Arnhem, and then we moved forward. I remember that my batman disappeared. Nobody knew what had happened to him. And he managed to disappear for about 2 days and then reappeared, much the worse for wear. He'd been drinking all the extra rum all that time. Gunnar Hughes, a gardener from Hereford. At Barnevelt, I can chiefly remember a pleasant gathering of all the battery. It was a whole battery was there, of course, all the battery officers. And we celebrated. We drank our drink. I took 6 photographs of the group in increasing states of disrepair and disarray. Somebody else took the photos, because I was in the photos all the time, as far as I remember. And just as a sideline, when we had the VE celebrations happened 10 years ago, whatever it was, the BBC cornered me, and I volunteered. I think they put out a notice saying anybody who had a photograph of interest taken on VE Day, they'd like to hear from. And I showed them one of these photos, and they got me, put me on television with it, which was rather amusing. I mean, a 90-second appearance on television called VEJ Stills, I think, which happened on Channel 2 after the news night every evening for a week, or 12 days, I suppose, altogether. And that was later on, anyhow. But the on VE night, VE evening, I remember, several of us got in a jeep. I suppose there were three or four of us, and we drove north to a little seaside town called Harderwijk, which was on the Zuider Zee. And there we drove into the town, and there was a T-junction, there was a sort of promenade along the waterfront, and we found an immense victory celebration going past. And so we were ushered into the procession and cheered to the echo all the way along. And I'm ashamed to say I remember standing up giving the Nazi salute. Yes, on the 29th of April, just before that, I don't know where I was driving, but that was after, of course, Arnhem had been captured. I remember driving somewhere in the country and going through a village, and was amused to see a great banner across the road, and inscribed on it was "Hitler is dude, God dank." this evening in Harderwijk, that was just fun. Came back, and next day we were ordered down to The Hague, and we sort of pulled ourselves together and went
in Netherlands. Is Barneveld in the Netherlands?
Barneveld, very much. I mean, all these places are in the Netherlands.
They're in the Netherlands, Belgium, right? Sorry,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realise that.
And then drove down the main route from Arnhem to The Hague. A rather pathetic drive, because there were starving people lining the road, old women, for instance. And I chiefly remember them calling out for soap. They all said, "Zape, zape." And we had no soap. We weren't allowed to give them anything, of course. We drove on, and
What were they? I mean, were they in really bad condition, the Dutch?
They were looking very starved, yes.
And what was their mood?
Their mood, their mood was one of desperation. I mean, they were just wanting to be rescued quickly. I think that was the thing. They realised that things, I hope they realised things were going to get better. But they weren't happy. They weren't waving flags or throwing flowers at us or anything. And we were then diverted round the Hague to, there was a sort of considerable suburbia going down towards the Hook of Holland. And we were sent to a place called Naaldwijk, I think, N-A-A-L-D-W-I-J-K. And
so you didn't stay in The Hague, Den Haag, long?
No. Yes. I mean, we didn't stay in the centre of The Hague at all. We were sort of, when we got on the main road, just entering the place, we were diverted off to the left, round the edge of the city. And at Naaldwijk, I'm trying to think. Oh, yes. I was detached, my troop, that was it. By that time, I'd been accepted for a war gunnery staff course at Manorbier in Pembrokeshire. And so I was waiting to go over for that. And so I was pulled out from my troop and taken into battery headquarters, and that was at Naaldwijk. My troop was established in a great underground fort at the back of the sand dunes on the coast, at a place called Loosdounen, I think, L-O-O-S-D-U-I-N-E-N. I may be wrong about that. Anyhow, that we'd only just about got established there, and the troops were then being used to take the German guard. The Germans had all sorts of little guard posts around there with a supply of rations, and they were all pulled out and concentrated somewhere or other, and I forget where, in readiness to be marched back to Germany. And our gunners were deployed in small numbers, perhaps two or three at a post, to guard this post and stop the Dutch from stealing all the German rations. And one evening, my battery headquarters people, including myself, were invited by somebody in Rijswijk, R-I-J-S-W-I-J-K, famous for the Treaty of Rijswijk in the Seven Years' War or something, to an evening party. They dug up all their buried drink from the end of the garden and were having a celebration. And at about a quarter to midnight, a dispatch rider arrived and handed a note to my battery commander, Peter Barnett, and he called me over and he said, "Now, there's been an unfortunate disaster. Mike and Peter have been killed. I want you to go at once and take over the troop." And so I was put on the pillion of the motorbike, driven to this underground fort, which I hadn't even seen. Our excellent troop sergeant major, Emrys Owen, received me, and a bed was made up for me on the German commander's desk in his office, and there were still German guards guarding the place. It was very strange. I slept with a window slightly open, looking out on a passageway with a wall behind. And every now and again, a German guard, fully armed, marched past outside. He could have chopped my head off quite easily. But they were well, I mean, they were totally subdued, of course, then. They wouldn't have done anything to save their lives. And next morning...
And what had happened to them? You know, you said there had been a fatal accident.
Oh, well, what had happened, yes, was that very foolishly, Peter Darcy, the troop commander, and Mike Morgan, the junior subaltern, with a driver, Ted Pullin was his name. He was a news agent from Yate in Gloucestershire. Had gone in the jeep round to one of these guard posts, and they wanted to go to another one, and it was about a 5 mile drive round an enormous area of high ground with water dikes and things about. And Peter looked at his map, I suppose, and saw that it was actually, as a crow flies, probably only a quarter of a mile or something. And so he said, right, well, I think we'll go across country that way. And they drove into a minefield. And there was the usual, I suppose it was, I don't know why they didn't see it, but the Germans always put low drooping wire fence, you know, just single wire on posts round, with a little tin sign with a skull and crossbones and Meenen written on it. Anyhow, Peter, Sammy Pullin, yes, he drove the jeep in. And then I think they realized that they were in a minefield. So Peter said, well, you two get clear, and I'm going to back the jeep out. And of course, their loyal fashion, they said, oh no, we're going to get out, we'll go back with you. And he backed them a foot or two and ran onto a mine, and the whole thing was blown up. The jeep was blown a very considerable distance and landed upside down. Peter Darcy was killed almost instantly. Mike Morgan was very seriously injured and was fetched by ambulance. And Sammy Pullin was not... he landed up underneath the jeep, as far as I remember, and was unconscious, and was only found quite a time afterwards. But he was actually the least injured, but had to be invalided out. And so that was that. I mean, of course, a day or so later, there was a funeral, and they were buried in a military cemetery. That was Loosdownan, that I said. And... I cannot remember the name of that fort. It was, began with G, it was Gross something or other, or something like that. It doesn't really matter.
No, it's right.
It was an enormous concrete-built place. A wonderful place to be billeted in, because the Germans did everything, of course, in style. And they had the most incredible optical equipment there. I remember looking through a rangefinder, and the magnification was so colossal that you could see the tower of the cathedral in Gouda, which was a city 5 or 6 miles away, and you could actually read the time on the clock on the top of the tower. This camp, when I got up next morning, began to see what was going on, there was an enormous underground sort of like, almost like a gun shed, like a large hangar or garage, in which were housed a group, I don't know how many, a dozen or 15 or something like that, Russian slaves, in the most appalling squalor. I can't remember what, I mean, they were removed and sent off, but that was a rather horrifying thing. And
I mean, what condition was they in? Can you talk that? How bad was it?
It's difficult to remember now, except that the squalor in which they lived, and they were seriously undernourished as well, and presumably were just being used to do menial tasks. Now, at that stage, there was the officer in charge of this fort was still there. He was an exceedingly nice, polite German, I mean, with Feldwebel or something, maybe the equivalent, I suppose, of a lieutenant in our army. I remember the appalling predicament I was put in, that he asked for an interview with me. And he then said that his wife was about to have a child and he wanted compassionate leave to go home. And I denied it to him. I said, I have no authority, I just don't know whether I should do this or not. I'm sorry, the answer is no, you go back with the troops. And a few days, now, at that stage, I was sent home. I went home on 10 days leave. We suddenly, the leave was reintroduced because the war was over. That was in early May, I suppose. And, no, wait a minute, maybe we've got beyond that, probably late May. And I went by train from a railhead somewhere nearby. I remember trundling slowly down in the train, and every time the train stopped, a great many of the passengers, who were all troops going on leave, would open the doors, jump out, run across the ground. One particular place, there was the edge of a village, and there were crowds of girls all leaning over the fence, their back gardens. These chaps all rushed over to them. It took an incredible time to get the train reloaded and moved on. We went to Ostend, and there we were loaded aboard one of the two ships that I knew as a child, sailing from Weymouth to the Channel Islands, the St. Julian and St. Helier. I forget which one it was. And I sailed over to Tilbury, went home to Salisbury for my leave, came back, forget which ship, it must have been the same route in reverse, I suppose, back again to Naaldwijk, where the unit still was. But while I was on leave, apparently the Germans had all been marched off, and they were made to go on foot unless they were injured. And there was a certain amount of horse transport still, and those who couldn't walk were put on the horse transport. And I'm told that when they paraded to load up, to march off in the morning, many, many of them had enormous bandages around their legs and their arms in slings and one thing and another. And so the officer in charge of the march off, the British officer, ordered that all bandages and slings should be removed. And a shower of wristwatches and jewellery fell out on the ground, apparently. And so they had to walk. And off they went, anyhow. And
they were going back to Germany.
They were going back to Germany, yes. And we knew nothing more of that. And I can't remember any... yes. Now, let me just think. Another unfortunate incident. At one of these guard posts was a gunner, Ernie, he came from Plymouth, I remember, I forget his surname, and he was a rather, we said in those days, rather a wet character, you know, and he had been ordered to pack up his kit, which you did by rolling up your blankets in your ground sheet and then tying the whole thing up with a signal wire. He did that, standing by with his rifle and his kit. And Lance Sergeant Johnny King came in a gun tractor. We'd still got our gun tractors, but no guns. And these were Bedford 3-ton tractors with a sort of passenger compartment immediately behind the driver's cab, very high up, and then there was all the gear was behind that. And Ernie, whatever he was, anyhow, threw his kit up into the cabin and then threw his rifle up. And his rifle slid off the thing and bounced down on its butt onto the ground. It was loaded and the safety catch was off, which of course was totally illegal, and it shot Sergeant Johnny King through the stomach and killed him. And Ernie Pierce, that was his name, he, I don't know what happened to him, I remember, He played the piano. He was one of the musicians. That was the end of him. We never saw him again. I mean, he was carted off. And I imagine was probably mentally affected by that. So we then had the funeral of Johnny King, and his group detachment sergeant, Sergeant Edwards, who was in civilian life a gamekeeper, and who by chance I met years later again in civilian life, drove the tractor and the rest of the detachment to the funeral in the same cemetery where the two officers had been buried a couple of days before. And in fact, there have been one or two more burials along the line. So Johnny King was separated from his officers by one or two spaces. And driving there, Sergeant Edwards put his arm out to indicate he was turning round a corner or something, and hit a telegraph pole and broke his arm. So he was invalided away. Somebody else, I suppose, took over the gun tractor. And these were all in my very last days there. And at Naaldwijk, where the battery headquarters was, there was a typical Dutch auction place where the auction was held on barges. A canal went through, and it was fenced all round, and in it we confined all the German equipment, guns, vehicles, whatever they left behind, and a whole lot of bicycles as well. And I was very anxious to buy a camera before I went home, and I went into The Hague, and in a small photographic shop, to my astonishment, was an Exacta single-lens reflex camera, which was something I had always wanted. And I went in and said to the man, how much do you want for that? And I forget exactly what he said. He wanted 4 motor tires, 2 cases of soap, 2,000 cigarettes or something like that, and a lady's bicycle. And I gathered together all that stuff and took it to him. And he said, oh, but this isn't a lady's bicycle. It's a man's bicycle. No good. And so I've got this confused, because he did give me the camera. The story's coming back. Yes, it was a lady's bicycle, and he took it, and I came triumphantly back with the camera. This was the very day before I was to go home for good. And we went into The Hague for a final farewell party, and awful things happened there. My battery commander leapt on the... The battery captain said that he'd lost all his money. It had disappeared from his battle dress. And so the battery commander leapt on the bar of the bar where we were.
Where were you?
In the Hague, yes. And said to the landlord, not a soul will move out of here till the money's repaid. And it was a terrible to do. And eventually the poor man did get some money and give it back. And meanwhile, somebody in a jeep had driven into a tram shelter outside and smashed all the glass, and the police came round, and the chap said, I'm awfully sorry I've done that, and the police apparently said to him, oh, don't bother, there's plenty of broken glass here. Nothing more came of that. And next morning back we went, and Bob Hitchcock, the battery captain, he was a troop commander, yes. Anyhow, he found the original money in an inner pocket of his battle dress. So I think the money was duly taken back and given to the landlord, but it was not very good for international relations.